Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Tomas Gaitkins, a renowned art historian, director of the Getty Research Institute and founding director of the German Center for Art History in Paris, former chair at the Collège de France, the Freie Universität in Berlin, fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study, the Getty, and recipient of many honorary degrees from the Courtauld, the Sorbonne, and numerous honors and awards. Yes, yes. And I'll make it short. The author of countless books and articles on 18th to 20th century French and German art history. Thank you so much for being with us today. I wanted to start by asking you, in the beginning of the history of the museum island in Berlin, about the Altes Museum by Schinkel, 1830, aspect where there, the kind of religious aspect in which there's a rotunda which resembles the Pantheon in Rome and a sense of the sacred, the statuary. Could you explain a little about this sense of the religious or sacred aspect of art as it was understood at this time?
You took it already very well.
But maybe beyond that, I'm just quoting Dr. Gaitkin's article, by the way. That's his ideas, which I repeated. But maybe then the public or the rulers, they understood that, could this be a kind of substitute for the church, you know, the post-Enlightenment?
Well, let me say, no, I mean, you are completely right. There is this kind of religious, I wouldn't say religious, but there is some kind of sacred element, yeah. which of course has to do, do we have to stop that?
Yeah, no, we'll just edit it. We'll just cut it out.
So, you know, let me say there is this element, you are completely right, because the temple front is of course already an element to elevate you.
Yeah.
So you go into a temple, and a temple, of course, is a sacred building. So this element is there. You go up some steps. You go up some steps, which also elevates you again.
Yeah.
And then you enter.
Yeah.
So that is definitely something which in a certain way describes the experience of art as something which should bring us outside our daily work into another sphere. That is absolutely true. However, let's also not forget the building, the Schinkel Altes Museum, was of course built first to collect all the collections, the major collections of the Prussian kings, which came back from Paris. And you know, it is a very interesting story that there was the fact that it was taken away or stolen from the Napoleon period and brought to Paris. It became more interesting, and it became the understanding that the collections were there, and they were in the different chateaus around Berlin.
Yeah.
And but when all this material and all these wonderful objects were brought to Paris, they suddenly got another value.
Yeah.
And when they came back, there were not the collections of the king's private rooms anymore.
Yeah.
They became a national collection.
Yeah.
So the idea from decoration of the castles was changed during this Napoleonic period. Napoleon, in a certain way, he was very instrumental in creating the different nations in Europe. The idea of nation building in the 19th century was created at this very moment. And when all these objects came back, nobody was thinking to redistribute them into the different castles, then to gather them for the people. So the idea from the private castles and the private apartments of kings to making them accessible to the general public, to everybody. That is the major idea.
Yeah.
And why, and then I come back to your point, why? Because art is necessary for everybody, and art has an educative element.
Yes.
So you have to see art to become a better person. And that's why everybody should go to museums to look at art, to get you into a higher level of understanding your life and yourself.
Yeah.
So you discover yourself only if you are exposed to art works, which then would, in a certain way, there is the enchantment, but it's more than enchantment.
Yeah.
It's also a change of your character and your soul. It's an educative process which takes place in yourself if you are confronted with art. And that's the idea of Wilhelm von Humboldt, who was the head of the group of the committee to install the museum.
Yeah.
And that is why the architecture, in a certain way, as you say, is a religious or has a sacred element, because you go into the other. And then we shouldn't forget the building is in front of the castle, which means the castle is, this is the castle of the king who gives his collection to the people. And he opens it, then, you know, great stairs over the whole, more or less the whole front of the building, inviting everybody to step in to get this kind of feeling and elevation, which art can provide.
You know, in thinking about this aspect of the public, I thought that maybe in today, in our more democratic period, it might seem surprising that there is this importance of the people, but at the same time, this is still a royal kingly. It doesn't mean that the regime is a democratic republican regime. It's the king and the royal government believe that the people have an important place, but still as subjects of the king.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is not. One shouldn't interpret it in a way that now this will change the social structure of a kingdom.
Yeah.
It is the idea coming out of the Enlightenment that art is part of a culture which is provided by the king in an educational way.
I think you had described also how this can also relate to the history of taste and so forth, in the sense that, for example, the Renaissance, as seen by Wilhelm Bode and Jakob Burckhardt, was important because of the idea of the individual, the free individual and creative, the sense of the individual's powers. And this is how the collectors and so forth saw the Renaissance at this period.
I think we should distinguish between the time around 1800.
Yes. This is later.
And the later period.
Yeah.
Of course, also in 1830, when the museum was opened, the collections were mainly Italian art from the Renaissance until the Baroque period. But I think the idea of Wilhelm von Bode, which then was realized in the Bode Museum or in the Kaiser Friedrich Museum, how it was called when it was opened, was different. So. We are in the period of Romanticism and Classicism and Romanticism in 1830, which is in a certain way different from interpretation of the Renaissance in around 1900. We have just another atmosphere and we have also a different society which is collecting. So in a certain way, the museum in 1830 was a museum which brought together the collections of the kings and opened, if you want, the castle's collections to the general public in an educational process. Whereas around 1900, a bourgeoisie, which existed at this time, which was with very successful entrepreneurs at the end of the 19th century, in this boom of the general social and economical development, identified with a period of the Italian Renaissance and collected themselves to, in a certain way, move into this area and try to establish themselves as the new princes, like the Medici princes. Right. And these kind of collections then went to the Bode Museum with Bode's consulting. So this is a different social and political and also economical area compared to the time around 1830.
In your lecture, you showed photographs of a couple of examples of rooms in villas of these bourgeois collectors, and also discussed Botta's concept of the style room, which incorporates painting and sculpture and so forth. Could you describe how these Botta's idea of the style room developed and how he came to take that approach?
This is a very interesting question, which needs more research. But what I can say is that Botta had from the very beginning an idea to combine the different genres. He was a specialist of Rembrandt paintings and Italian sculptures of the 15th and 16th centuries and of other areas, the Middle Ages. But he was very much interested also in the history of the decorative art. And he was not only studying one direction of the arts, he was really interested in getting an idea of the whole period and in all its different interpretations. Yeah. And so he collected tapestries and fabrics and ceramics and all kinds of decorative arts he could get from this period. The idea was to create an atmosphere of the moment in history, which he tried to get everything together so that you could have an idea of how Medici prince was living in Florence. Yeah. So to reconstruct in a certain way an interior of a rich merchant in the 16th century in Florence or Rome. And this was, of course, artificial because it was random what you could get.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
In a certain way, he tried to reconstruct that.
Yeah.
And the his collectors were, of course, the ideal people to try that out.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
They were interested and they wanted to learn from him, and they wanted to create their atmosphere around them, which was an atmosphere of prestige, wanted to demonstrate. But there were models, if you ask for the models where it came from. I think it's not really an invention of Botta, because you know you had these great collections by the Rothschilds in Paris. And then Spitzer, who was one of the Rothschild bankers, he had an absolutely fabulous collection. And they were living with this. And, you know, there is a very strong French collecting tradition behind Botta's concept. Botta was quite often going to Paris. He was also going often to London, but he also knew the collections in Paris.
Yeah.
And so this kind of atmosphere he was trying to get into the Berlin ambitious collectors, and he tried out how this would work and how that could be brought into a display in the museum. And the Botta Museum, or the Kaiser Friedrich Museum in 1904, tried in the display to do two things. First of all, he was absolutely aware that the major paintings, for example, should have their free room. So he was very careful. If you look at the walls, if you interpret these different walls, we have photographs.
Yeah.
So we know exactly how it looked like. He was very aware not of preventing that a major Rembrandt or Raphael had its space so that it could be contemplated without any destruction. And then he says himself, sometimes I have put some element of the decorative arts close to these paintings to bring the visitor to this space, to give it an accent in the room.
Yeah.
So he was really, and then sometimes he had a fabric behind the statue to give more relief to the statue.
Wow.
So in a certain way, what he was trying to do was to create the atmosphere of the time, and at the same time, evaluating the object itself so that it comes out in his uniqueness, in his special character.
Yeah.
So what he really didn't want, and many people criticized, is that this is just a kind of flea market, you know? Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he wanted to prevent. So if you try to interpret that, you can find out that there is a strong element to distinguish between important works of art and lesser important
yes.
works of art. So you can read the display
yeah.
if you really look a little bit closer.
I believe that you'd also mentioned as the museum field developed, there was some conflict between, I guess, the ethnological approach of collecting objects simply as representatives of a culture, as opposed to the connoisseurial approach of finding the best, greatest examples. And this played out in the museum.
Well, I mean, he was looking to combine that.
Yeah.
In a certain
okay.
way.
Okay.
You know, but look at our museums today.
Yeah.
You know, most of the museums are representation of the history of art at the wall. So it is the Vasarian concept. You know, you go from Botticelli to the late Vasari,
yeah.
and you have representations on the wall. I mean, the public is not really prepared to really follow that, you know,
yeah,
because
yeah.
they have no idea about the art historical background.
Right.
In a certain way, what we do is to put our Western art historical knowledge, we try to describe this art historical narrative on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have the material to do that, sometimes you have gaps.
Yeah.
But basically, that's how painting galleries are displayed now. And that's exactly what Bode didn't want to do.
Ah.
Bode wanted to create an atmosphere of the time and represent the major works of art in their individuality at the same time. So it is a kind of combination. It can be sometimes confusing,
yeah.
and it can be sometimes also, sometimes it doesn't work. So I wouldn't today reconstruct Bode.
Yeah.
That is not possible. And you don't want to do this because,
yeah.
you know, first of all, he had his material and we have now more
yeah.
other material and we have other ideas about the works of art he had. So we wouldn't do this. But in a certain way, we might come in the next decades or so
yeah.
to find a compromise between these two
yeah.
possibilities. There is, you know, if you go to a great collection like the Metropolitan Museum or the Washington National Gallery, they have an abundance of, let's say, 16th and,
right.
Century Renaissance art. And so, but, you know, the complete separation of decorative arts and paintings
right.
Is artificial.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
It comes out of a certain tradition, how mm-hmm. we teach art history, how we have developed knowledge in different periods. I think we might consider bringing this a little bit better
yeah.
together. You know, and also rooms with only decorative arts. It's nice to study the different forms and the specialists are happy.
Yeah.
But why not have some kind of a combination? I mean, more
yeah.
and more I have the feeling that this is already on the way and
yeah.
many galleries are trying to make these galleries more lively in
yeah.
combining these different genres.
It's not only for the specialists, after all, who
yeah.
to see it.
No, absolutely.
I
museums are not only for art historians.
Yes, yes, yes. I wanted to ask you also, I was very interested that, again, with the history of taste in the late 19th century, that I guess the certain maybe political overtones for certain artists, for example, you mentioned Bode's study of Rembrandt, who I understand was a representative of the Dutch Republic and the kind of democratic values of freedom and so forth. But then also this case of the conflict over impressionism and the taste for more conservative academic battle scenes versus
right.
international French impressionism. Could you describe some of this kind of conflict in different tastes and the different camps?
Well, this is a very big
subject.
Anyway, I mean, at the same time when Bode was building his museum, you know, this society in Germany under Wilhelm II, but
yeah.
already before, was a very divided society. And on the one hand, you know, you have to know there was an academy in Berlin, which
yeah.
was run by
yeah.
who was a rather conservative artist coming out of the realist tradition in
right.
Germany, following the classical tradition of the hierarchy of genres, where the history painting is the most important genre, and then come all the others. And he was a genre and history painter, and painted the most important official events of the royal court, like the proclamation of the empire in 1871 in Versailles. So he did this very important historical painting. And this was the taste of the emperor. And the emperor, especially William II, was very convinced that he had a very good taste. He was following this kind of tradition. But especially the Jewish successful entrepreneurs, they had other interests. And they also were international. And so they had contacts to France, they had contacts to England, they had contacts to Italy. So they, of course, were educated.
Yes.
They were interested in developing also the taste further. So this was the society where the director of the Museum of the National Gallery could find help to acquire modern and contemporary art. Very early, already in the 1890s, the director, Hugo von Tschudi, was going to Paris and was able to acquire Impressionist paintings at a time when even in France contemporary paintings didn't go into the Luxembourg. Was it Lex Caillebotte then?
Yeah.
It started that Impressionist paintings were acquired by the state, but it was rather late or more or less at the same time when the Germans already had bought these paintings. And there was even one family, the Bernsteins, they already bought Manet's in the 80s. And so in the 80s, you could also see a very, very important collection of Impressionist paintings in Berlin. So that was rather early in the reception of modern and contemporary art. So you had, on the one hand, this trend of moving on to propagate modern and contemporary art, especially French art. And then it went into the early 20th century with very important dealers like Cassira, who of course had the gallery in Berlin, which was selling Renoir and Monet and Manet and whatever you can think of. And major paintings, which are now at the Courthold, were in Berlin for a moment. They didn't find a buyer, but they weren't. So they could have been bought. People bought other paintings, but not these ones. But in a certain way, it was a very lively intellectual atmosphere. Parallel to that was Buddha. Buddha was favorable up to a point. He respected Impressionism. He was a friend of Liebermann, and he had a very beautiful painting by Liebermann in his house. And he didn't go as far as the Blaue Reiter, the Brücke, or the more modern artists, which then revolted against the Impressionists in a certain way around 1910 or so.
Right.
He didn't understand the Expressionists, and he didn't understand abstract painting.
Right.
That was not his world anymore. But he was tolerant to the acquisitions of Impressionists. It's not that he was extremely helpful to Hugo von Tschudi, because they were trying to convince the same people to help them, you know. So these collectors had, let's say, ancient furniture and Impressionist paintings, and some had Renaissance paintings and also an Impressionist painting.
Yeah.
So that's always, you know, if you do fundraising, you fish in the same area of people. So, so in a certain sense, they were also competing with these interesting, especially above all, a Jewish community, which I understood, different from America. Rich collectors around 1900 did not come from the Jewish background as in Europe. That was a complete different. This is very interesting.
Maybe it was maybe later at a later date.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was. Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you also about the conception of architecture, especially among the later, you already discussed the Altesmuseum, but as the other, the National Gallery, and then the Kaiser Friedrich Museum and the Pergamon Museum, there was some way in which these buildings reflected the royal history, but they were also more modern. Could you describe?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I'll tell you only if you give me a little bit more coffee.
Yes, please.
What I think about this. Thank you. This is very fascinating. We have the Altesmuseum, which is a neoclassical building.
Yes.
And it is a temple architecture.
Yeah.
And then we have the Neues Museum, which is which is in between the Altesmuseum and the National Gallery.
Right.
It is a very beautiful building, but it is not, it has no temple front. And the National Gallery is, of course, another Acropolis building, and was opened at a moment where the German Empire was just proclaimed. And it was, in fact, the inscription says 71, but this is not true, alluding to the proclamation of the Prussian king as emperor in Versailles, but it was in fact opened only in 76. But you know, it was of course a confrontation to France. Germans now finally, you know, and it was a provocation to France. Germans now are united and are building one nation, and the Prussian king is the representative of this German nation, also in providing and helping to build a museum for all Germans. So this is also a political statement, which is very clear in the architecture. So the next building, the Kaiser Friedrich Museum, is a Baroque building.
Uh-huh.
And this is a Prussian building.
Yeah.
And the building is, the whole concept of the architecture by Ine is to remind the Potsdam chateaus. So it is more or less Baroque, or let's say Rococo architecture, and not so much a classical architecture. So it alludes to the Prussian tradition and alludes to Frederick, who had this great collection of French paintings and then also bought Italian and Flemish paintings. So this is, from the outside, a more Baroque Prussian tradition. And then it is a history of architecture with a lot of meaning, because if you enter, you have a huge Baroque dome.
Yes.
Yeah. And then in this dome, you have the statue, normally the statue outside, but inside you had, you know, the founder of the Prussian kingdom.
Yeah.
And he is inside. So this is, of course, a dedication to Prussia. And then you go inside, and then you are in a 15th century Renaissance church, which then, of course, relates to Bode's idea to have the pieces the collection had, and which he mostly acquired, could be seen in the respective architecture.
Yeah.
So he built the architecture for the collection.
Yeah.
So this Renaissance chapel is an artificial chapel. It is not a chapel, but it is to give the altars their charisma or their spirit, where they could be seen in the context in which they have been placed in the first place. So, and then you, if you go through, you come into the staircase, which guides you into the second floor. Yeah. And there you have a kind of cupola, which is a complete 18th century architecture. And the design is taken from Knobelsdorf, or the architects of Frederick the Great. And you have also the statue of Frederick the Great with his generals in the niches of the cupola. This is an architecture parlante. Mm-hmm. It is a historicist architecture, which of course certainly relates to the earlier period. There is a whole idea that the greatness and the tradition of supporting the arts by the Prussian kings.
Yeah.
And then the Pergamon Museum is a big break. Of course, Messer goes back in a certain way to the tradition of Schinkel and the classical antiquity, but in a modern way.
Yeah.
Of course, Peter Behrens was before, you know, and so all modern and contemporary architecture goes into this, again, classical architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a revival of classicism in a complete different time. And started, not to forget, still started under the Prussian king. Wilhelm II was still out when they started to build the pogrom, which then only was finished in 1930, a Buddhist death in 29.
This is the Athenaeum Review. Our guest today is Thomas Gaitkens, whose visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History.